Hi, I'm Amy Halpern Lath.
And I'm John Moskow. Welcome to Ethical Schools. Our guests today are Stephen Evangelista and Anthony Celestine. Steve is a longtime educator and co-founder and former principal of Harlem Link Charter School in New York City. Anthony Celestine is the director of the Office of Juvenile Justice Services in Calcasieu Parish, Louisiana. For those unfamiliar with Louisiana, a parish is the equivalent of a county elsewhere. Welcome, Steve and Anthony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How did you two find each other?
I can take that one if that's all right, because I reached out and found Anthony. Actually, it has to do with the reason we're here to talk about, which is assessment centers. I'm an educator who has not been involved in the criminal justice system at all in my career, but I found my way to this work as an advocate and as a learner because of relationships with past students who got involved in the justice system. So I learned about assessment centers, which we'll talk about today, and I sought out Anthony because he's one of the senior people in the movement who I could learn a lot from, and I wanted to connect with him.
That's about as accurate as it could be.
Anthony, the Louisiana Models for Change of the MacArthur Foundation called Calcasieu Parish's Assessment Center, the Multi-Agency Resource Center, or MARC, an innovative model and truly exceptional. What is MARC and what makes it innovative?
So the MARC was developed as a way to fill in some gaps in a system that was very strong in reform efforts. We were doing great work early on in our reform efforts from about 2003 to about 2010. Then we hit like a brick wall where we had saw the successes as it relates to the system, where fewer kids were coming into detention, fewer kids were being petitioned to court. And we just plateaued out and we realized there were still gaps in the processes of kids getting services early on without juvenile justice intervention. So it was developed. We got seed money from the MacArthur Foundation to do a feasibility study with community stakeholders. It's one thing we do really well in Calcasieu is collaborate with system partners, non-governmental partners, education, law enforcement, anybody that wants to be at the table to push forth good work to support kids, and came together with this model, had an opportunity to look at a number of assessment centers across the country, some that were ran by law enforcement, some that were ran by systems, and some that were ran by community agencies, and almost basically grabbed the best of all. And it really helps us develop as a single point of entry to support families and kids that are in need of anything, whether it's community needs, whether it's support from law enforcement or system involved work. We will work with any community partner that makes that referral. And one of our biggest partners right now is the school system.
So, Anthony, don't families tend to find it a little problematic or scary to be involved in a system that is affiliated with the justice system?
Right. And so that's a great question. I would have to put the disclaimer out is that families don't really need to seek our agency for supports because there's various community supports. However, we've modeled ourselves in such a way that we basically inform families that you don't need to be arrested or have a law enforcement or court referral to receive front-end services immediately. If there's a community referral sent to us because a family, a child is struggling with something, whether it's just, you know, suspected substance abuse issues or drug issues, we will let them come in voluntarily just to assess their needs and talk with them and link them with community supports. Our job is to be community connectors and conveners. We're basically there just to support them in developing, you know, a plan to operate off of their natural strengths. So you don't necessarily have to be involved in a system to get services. And that's the model that we're selling. Although it's our agency sits in a juvenile justice agency, well, it's housed in the juvenile justice agency, it's set apart from our actual juvenile justice facility. It's a separate home-like environment office that we don't call our staff over there probation staff or anything. They're just basically MARC support officers and community providers. So it is really not connected to the system, although it's housed in the system, if that makes sense.
Would it be helpful if I gave an educator's perspective on demystifying what an assessment center is
Sure.
for the audience?
Yeah.
So I think a couple of key things that Anthony has said are collaborate, and the title of this organization includes multi-agency, and these are elements that are missing from the school reform and just education system efforts around the country in a lot of places. Assessment centers are a general term for many, and there are dozens of them around the country, locally designed and locally implemented agencies that work with the school system with the express purpose of reducing the number of youth justice encounters. And that, in my experience as a New York City educator for 25 years, is a unique experience. In my experience, you've got schools that are frustrated with children who are going through many struggles. Schools feel disconnected from the different systems that the families might engage in or with to get support. And these children end up sometimes being thrown away. They're housed in these detention centers that are like warehouses, or charter schools are famous for pushing kids out who have all these struggles. And schools sometimes are at the end of their ability to support families and don't know what to do next. And what places like the MARC Center do is provide that last stop to connect the family to another resource that may not be have already been uncovered or may not be connected for them, and prevent children from going down a path that would lead to a justice encounter. And again, in my experience, schools are afraid to touch the justice system for the same reason you said, John, that there's a stigma attached to it, or maybe as you, Amy, with the question. But if we're going to interrupt the school to prison pipeline, these systems have to work together and collaborate. And from the child's experience, who goes through a school system and then a justice encounter, they're completely different worlds, but they need to be connected if we're going to prevent children from falling into these traumatizing environments.
And if it works well, it's a beautiful relationship because, really and truly, we want to develop those off ramps from the justice system. And we found over the years that working with families on a voluntary basis early on, it really reduces the need for them to be in a formal setting eventually with the justice system. I think the key word to developing a beautiful relationship with the justice system and the school system is trust. Trust that you are going to be able to address the basic needs that that child may come to you with, and that you will definitely, continue to place them in the appropriate services, but also convene back with them to share information back and forth. So it's a two-way street of supporting that child, and along with these two major partners, community providers that will also work in a wraparound fashion to support the needs of that child and family is very key to early on success for that family. So our goal is to be that major disruptor to the school of prison pipeline and really work with our educators on the front end as best as possible.
Anthony, a VERA study in 2014, I guess 10 years ago, found that although MARC had very positive benefits for young people who came to it, there wasn't always a match between the services that a young person seemed to need and the services to which they were referred. Was that accurate at the time? And if so, have you been able to improve these matches since then and how? Because obviously we
Yes,
know
that.
that interagency communication and so forth can always be a difficult task in practice.
I think that outcome study was done early on. I think somewhere around 2012, 2011. And we were fairly new. We were operating from the mindset of that we wanted to be a single point of entry. And we wanted to support the actual time from law enforcement contact to justice referral process. We want to reduce that time and basically be a single point of entry, as well as support law enforcement. Now, the key to that was, in order to understand that dynamic, is to understand this. Systems that have a strong collaborative effort that fail are failing because of one central component, is that you don't have the most dominant or prominent agency involved, which is law enforcement. So you have to get law enforcement involvement in early on. You get that buy-in, and then you're able to triage and change things. So early on, we were there to reduce referral and court processing time and creating a single point of entry to support law enforcement and the district attorney's office. But in 2014, we almost hit a wall. Like, we were being successful, but there was a need for change. And that's when we used, through adaptive leadership and challenges, we realized we're doing well, but does a kid need to be placed, handcuffed and placed in the back of a law enforcement vehicle to receive timely services? And that was the defining moment for us to switch our whole philosophy and really collaborate with our partners and provide direct services to the school system, to child welfare and attendance, to the Department of Children and Family Services, and really expanding our hours of operation to just support through advertisement, letting families know, hey, if there's a need and you don't know what to do, there's a crisis, you don't know what to do, come and see us. Let us work with you and your child. So we've changed that whole mindset of let's just focus on what we see in front of us and place what we think we need to put in place. Right now, we're operating with the family as the drivers. The families are the navigators. They're determining the needs that their child has, and we will work with them through assessments and screening instruments to get them where they need to be. So, yes, I would say at the time that was accurate, but right now we are really flourishing in an environment where families are the driver of the services that their children are connected with, and it's very successful. Our numbers that we're seeing for, we're keeping kids even from light touches to the system and even re-referrals. Those numbers are astronomical, and I would like to pull some of those numbers up if I can. And it's to the tune like of this, since we've opened in 2011, we provided 39% of the kids that have come into our system, the Mark Center, with immediate supports within hours. Since that inception, we've diverted over 86% of all children presented to our agency with a formal referral, and 32% we've kept from a light touch. That's just like somebody walking in saying, "Hey, we're struggling with this a particular issue. Can you assist us with that?" And we provided immediate help to that family. And we track things through data. We're very data driven, so we track everything. We report to the National Assessment Center, report our data through this system called ACORN. It's an acronym, and it's for Assessment Center Data. And we also provide satisfaction surveys to every family that comes into our agency to see if we met the mark that they were requesting, if we met their needs. And we're getting overwhelming positive feedback from those families. And that's a voluntary survey. So when you're connecting with people in the appropriate way, you get the appropriate feedback that you need to know that you're doing things the right way.
I as you talk, I think about a former student of mine who, when he graduated, first graduating class of the school that I founded, he was the one who was most affected by the impending end of school, and going off to middle school. He was crying, and his family was teasing him about it. And he was a very successful student, very well liked. After that graduation, he fell off the map and was not involved with any of our alumni events, and I didn't hear much about him until years later when I found out from another alum of the school that he was incarcerated for conspiracy to drug trafficking and gang involvement. And in talking with his mom, she said, "I just couldn't compete with the streets, and I didn't have a way of keeping him away from the temptations of that life." And I imagine what it was like for her feeling isolated as she did. And if there was a resource like the Mark where she could go and find credible messengers, find people who could connect with this child on a different level than she could as the parent, and then we could as the school, who was his elementary school, not involved formally with him anymore, but still cared about him. And if you in your agency would connect with his school personnel and find the one person at that school who could connect with this child, maybe there could have been a way to keep him away from the streets. And tragically, after being released and being, in a diversion program, he was picked up again. He was back involved in selling drugs, and he actually passed away in the jail system this year. So I think
That's
about this, the stakes of not having something like this. And we have all these resources in a big, in big cities, but we don't have that connectivity and that seamless relationship between systems to care for children as they go through the different stages of their growth. I think about how this child, maybe it wouldn't have, but it could have made a difference.
And John, I want to go back to your point, the question that you asked earlier with that Vera outcome assessment study. Although, and I wanted to double back to that, although, there was concern about the connectivity to the appropriate service match, we did realize that there were factors that determined that kids were better off. We were able to reduce the case processing time from 17 days to 13 days, meaning that we were able to get a formal connector, a formal approval from the district attorney's office to work with a child in diversion. The chances of reoffending went down by about 26%, from 26% to 12%. And then, if I'm thinking correctly, status referrals. These are kids that are like more of a threat to themselves, runaway, ungovernable, and have truancy issues. That has decreased by fivefold. So we've seen early on success, and just because we did not hit the full mark that we wanted, it really pushed us to reinvent ourselves in 2014, as I mentioned earlier, to be that early disruptor to work with our community partners in a successful way. So I just want to double back to that.
Wow. Anthony, Louisiana is known as a law and order state. I mean, that may be more from the outside than what you're seeing on the inside, but given that, how are you able to elicit, so much support from a lot of different stakeholders in that environment?
So what happens is this: Louisiana had, well, Calcasieu Parish, which we're seated at the southwest end of Louisiana. If you look at Louisiana on a map, it looks like a shoe. So the hill is Calcasieu Parish, Lake Charles, Louisiana. Then the toe would be New Orleans. The arch would be Baton Rouge. And the strap where you pull your boot up would be Shreveport. Well, so all of these locations were involved in juvenile justice reform with the Casey Foundation through JDAI, the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. At the same time, we were also working with the MacArthur Foundation's Model for Change in reforming our system. Calcasieu was very different. I always go back to the word collaborate. We had a strong collaborative effort early on, and that continues today. Although some of the faces have changed, the mission and the goal is still there to work to provide better outcomes for our children so that they can all be happy, healthy, and successful as they approach adulthood. Also in Louisiana, most of juvenile justice reform takes place at a local level. So we have a split system like everybody else. We have a state system, which is the Office of Juvenile Justice. Then you have your local systems that drive local detention, probation, and front-end services. We just chose not to bend the way we chose not to bend back and take steps backwards instead of folding when things get tough and say, okay, well, this is just the way it is, and this is how kids are. We're going to go back to doing things this way. No, it just pushed us to forge on to be more creative. We've learned early on that through adaptive measures, you can figure out how to overcome a lot of things. We had an opportunity to exercise that early on in 2014 when we had judicial partners that wanted to suspend our screening instrument, meaning this is, we had an objective screening instrument to determine how would kids be placed in detention or to assure that we were placing the appropriate kids into detention. Well, a couple of judges didn't want to use that instrument. So what did we do? We became innovative. We sought our law enforcement partners and told them to utilize your discretion. If you don't think that child needs to be placed in detention or brought to our system, but instead brought to the mark and we could service them immediately, do so. So we learned early on that law enforcement doesn't want to arrest every child that they come into contact with. Thus gave us the moniker or the term that, or even the saying that not every child needs to be placed in handcuffs, put in the back of a police patrol unit and brought to the detention center for services. So that's how we were able to do that. But continuing to push innovation, continuing to link with best practices across the country, working with the Casey Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the National Assessment Center, but also being that driver behind state legislation and statewide detention standards, statewide juvenile detention alternatives collectives. We've been pushing reform efforts, and that's why Calcasieu Parish is different from other areas in the state. And juvenile detention reform will continue to push forward. Although the overall messaging, juvenile justice in the state has gone from reform to crime prevention. We're not going to take that crime prevention motto. We're going to continue to push reform efforts to support our families and meet them where they are.
Following up on Amy's question, I think you've been involved in alternatives to detention, I think your entire career of decades. And I'm just curious, have you seen significant changes in general attitudes in Calcasieu Parish over that time? And are there particular things that you think make it distinctive, so that what you were just describing of this openness to innovation and willingness to sort of focus on what's really good for young people. I mean, because it's just so
Yes.
exciting. And also I think, it's sort of like, needless to say, if people can be doing it, there, what lessons can people be learning elsewhere?
Well, I go back again to those two words that you will hear me say over and over. It's collaboration and trust. And when I say that, it's our system partners, child welfare, community, families, law enforcement, prosecutors, and our own internal team breed that happy, healthy, and successful mindset. So we're seeing through data and outcomes, the more you share successes, the more people will buy into what you're selling. And I think having that constant message at our Children and Youth Planning Board, which is the oversight, it was the board that was developed through legislation in Louisiana to oversee projects for as it relates to kids in your community. And each one of those system stakeholders that I mentioned earlier are involved with that, as well as parents and judicial partners. And I guess you can say local government, elected officials. So we all come together to look at these outcomes every other month just to make sure that we're meeting our mark. And so through data, we're showing that early informal intervention that's voluntary on the basis or on the side of the family will increase that front-end work, but it decreases things that matter. Like there's no net widening. Our status offense diversion numbers have decreased. And these are the kids, once again, that are either truant, running away from home, are ungovernable, or kids that are under the age of 10 that have they committed some type of had they been 13 years old and committed that offense, they would be considered as a delinquent. So we've worked to help reduce that and support that. But also, even in Louisiana, in 2019, when Raise the Age came into effect, where we took 17-year-olds into our system, we saw our diversion numbers continue to decrease because of the front-end work that we were doing. Then we also saw the number of kids being petitioned to court, formal petition to court. Those numbers have dropped from 2017 at 275 to 2023 to 160, which is amazing. And this is including 17-year-olds into that system. But most importantly, from 2017 to 2023, our detention admission numbers have dropped from 348 to 173. So this shows that the system is operating upright. We are working with the school system and other partners informally with those families, putting them in the driver's seat to seek this work early on or the supports early on, and reducing that need to be in that formal system where we know, and what Steve has been stating, once you get linked into this part of the system, it really opens that pipeline up to go into, residential facilities or group home facilities and or state juvenile correctional facilities. So that early on, work and decriminalizing a lot of behaviors that the four of us that we've probably engaged in at some point in time that we've never been brought to the system, but we just did things that were natural for children. And I feel like children should not be punished for natural behaviors. We need to support them and assess or screen their needs early on to figure out what traumatic experiences they are bringing to the school system or how they're showing up every day. You never know how a child's showing up, you know, and I get that from my wife, who's a school counselor, a middle school counselor, that just sees how a child shows up, and it's her job to figure out why. And so if it works in the school system in a clinical setting, it could work in a juvenile justice system in a clinical setting.
I'd like to, if that's okay, restate a couple of things that I heard Anthony say just now with the intention of explaining some vocabulary that was new for me as I became a learner here. I found in an informal survey of my colleagues, more than half of secondary school principals don't know what diversion is, and almost all elementary school principals don't know what diversion is. So your audience may not know what diversion is, and Anthony's talking a lot about diversion. Diversion, as I understand it, is alternatives to sentencing for people who have been convicted or picked up for crimes. Not necessarily convicted, but it's keeping people out of jail through community programs. It's a version of restorative justice to repair harms and learn rather than serve your time as in punishment. He's saying that the instances of diversion are going down, not because they're putting more kids behind bars, but because they're doing more preventive work to keep them from even getting to that stage. And diversion is almost entirely reactive. It's after a child's been picked up, after what he called a status offense, which is something else that was new to me. Status offense being something that isn't necessarily a crime that's going to harm the community, but is something that's going to be on your record and means you did something bad. Like you said, Anthony, harming yourself rather than your community. And he also mentioned net widening. He said there's no net widening. That's a very important concept in law enforcement where you may have a good idea that's preventive in purpose. Let's check every child's backpack for guns. You know, great, we're going to keep guns out of the schools. At the same time, you're going to catch things now that would ordinarily not be caught, that don't need to be caught, brought into the system. Ordinary behaviors that are risky behaviors teenagers engage in that don't need to be brought to a formal justice resolution. Net widening means you're increasing the number of people who are now involved in the system with your otherwise well-intentioned efforts. And there are ways to determine whether an effort is engaging in net widening or not. But you're hearing from Anthony that these efforts in prevention are actually reducing the number of kids who are housed in their detention centers and the number of kids who are brought into the system in general. So I think it's incredible what you're doing there. And the relationship with schools at whatever level it is, it's unique in my experience.
Yeah, I was really struck, Anthony, by your comment about the net widening as well, because I think that also speaks to the question Amy was asking before about people's parents perhaps hesitance in getting involved, and the fact that, you know, that they're seeing that this does not mean in any way that their kids are more likely to get involved with the juvenile justice system is, you know, is really powerful. I had a question for Steve, which is because I think you've been looking at assessment centers around the country, and I was curious if you've found patterns of, you know, what makes assessment centers successful and where they have difficulty.
I think you heard Anthony say it like beating a drum, you know, trust and collaboration. That's what I hear as I listen in and talk to people who are involved in these successful programs. One thing I've heard repeatedly is let's connect youth and families to community rather than systems. I've heard about being intentional about using data to develop off-ramps to keep kids from getting into the system in the first place. And I've heard about the trust in the community. I've heard people in assessment centers pretty universally say the answers are already there in the communities. So our job is just to help connect the dots and to be a trusting partner to support families in going through this process. And you hear Anthony say, I put the family in the driver's seat. You know, in education, we have this tension where there are standards and there are top-down reforms and there are expert educators who are imposing things on families and children, and an assessment center flips that around and says, no, the families are the experts on what their children need, and we're here to support them and give them tools and let them drive the boat.
You've also looked at assessment centers through the country in terms of the environments that make them most likely to be successful. I was thinking demographics or urban versus rural versus suburban. What are you seeing?
Well, that's part of the reason why I'm passionate about this subject is I don't see these centers taking off in big cities. Calcasieu, and I've learned to say it properly, Calcasieu Parish, part of the Sioux, is more of a rural community. I've seen them successful in Clark County in Nevada, in Savannah, Georgia, I believe it is, or Augusta, Memphis, Boise, Idaho, Grand Rapids, Michigan. These are places that are mid-sized cities at best. But Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles, yeah, there really isn't a stronghold for this concept. And my understanding in talking with people who could make a difference in New York for developing an assessment center is that big cities are just seen as too complicated, too bureaucratic, too filled with turf wars, too big. You have a place, I believe it's Grand Rapids, that has about 30,000 kids in the entire district. That's just one district in New York City, and we've got 32 of them. So, how do you network all of these services and build trust in a kind of a small town way in a place that is so packed with people and services that are piled on top of each other? And there are agencies that try to do parts of assessment center work all over New York City and other cities. So, how do you not duplicate efforts when you're just trying to collaborate and connect the dots? So, I think there are many reasons why these agencies or this system hasn't developed in big cities. I don't think it's hopeless. I think it can happen, but it's going to take people smarter than me to figure that out.
And Steve, I'd like to piggyback on off of Steve's statement. Other than New York, every site that you named, Calcasieu Parish has worked with, either through technical assistance in our agency in and of itself and or through the National Assessment Center. But one of the biggest takeaways I want the audience to receive is this. I'm very proud of some of the work that we've been doing with our local school system to decriminalize a lot of behaviorists that would show up to the front door of some juvenile justice agencies, like the vaping issue, the school zero tolerance fights, the truancy issues. We've been able to decriminalize all of those type of offenses. And that was a partnership between myself, our three juvenile and family court judges, our district attorney, and our school superintendent. When you have your school superintendent and all of his or her top brass on board for this juvenile justice reform work, that's important. That's huge buy-in. And when you share the stage with your school superintendent at the local news media or the local news station or outlets talking about ways to fight human trafficking and support front-end work, that's huge. That's another selling card where your community sells the service that you provide without you opening your mouth. So, we've worked with over 1,500 school age kids in Calcasieu Parish over in 2023 on school fights and vapes. They came to us and said, hey, if you develop a program that can support this, we don't want these kids to be brought to court. We don't want these kids arrested on our campus. And the judges don't want their dockets inundated with something that's more of a behavioral type concern as opposed to a criminal offense. So we've developed a process and we've worked with all these kids voluntarily on a voluntary basis. We worked with over 1,500 kids for a first-time school referral. The second, those that came in for a subsequent second referral, that number reduced to 143. And those that came in for a third referral, that number is reduced to 10. So you went an overall total number of kids that the school board sent to us to support them, 1,527 kids, to those coming in for a second referral to 143, and those for a third referral to 10. That's a huge success. So that whatever we're doing and my staff supporting them and the community is supporting them, it's working. It's working so much to the tune now that they met with us about a month ago to introduce a new concept. Kids that are up for expulsion with their third school suspension. If these other programs are working, how can you guys support us? We know there is an issue going on with that child. Can we refer them to you guys to see if there is a misdiagnosis? Is there some community services that need to be provided? I mean, does the parent struggle with housing? Are they homeless? Just a number of things that, we can look into to determine what the outward action of that child is. And hopefully we can support that and come back with good data, like we showed with the vaping situation and the truancy issues and the school fights. So if we could revisit this conversation at this time next year, hopefully we will have additional data to support our partnership with the school system as something that I've never seen before in the country. And I've been in this work for over 28 years, but we're going to ride the wave right now. We don't know what it's going to look like in 5 years, but I would hope in 5 years we're just as successful then as we are now. But I am really excited about the work we're doing with our partnership with the school system.
That's
That's
great.
really exciting about the schools coming to you and saying, how can you help them with their discipline systems and avoiding expulsions and stuff? It really will
And
be
we're
interesting
not
to
taking,
revisit.
yeah, and we're not taking that. I mean, they're still doing what they have to do on their campus. Each campus at our schools have a school resource officer as well that works in the sheriff's office. And once again, if you can work with certain things informally, it doesn't take those guys and ladies off of the campus. Where if there is a true need or a true emergency or a threat that they can address that. Let us deal with the low-hanging fruit informally. It seems to work well.
Steve, what would you suggest for our listeners who are in schools that could use this sort of interagency concept of an assessment center?
Well, he mentioned the JDAI community, which is I see it as a message board. It's a compendium of resources. Well, you just Google JDAI and you can join for free, and it becomes you're a member of the community and you can learn what's going on. You can connect with other people. I would also suggest looking at the National Assessment Center's website and signing up for their updates. That just, as an educator, your first step is the learning curve of the justice language and the justice systems. So it's not directly answering your question of what do I do if I have a problem in my school. But I think if we're going to do this well, we need to think big picture about connecting and building community rather than being in our separate spheres. But I would then say, you can act as a mini assessment center yourself as an educator, whatever your role is. Got relationships, walk the streets of the community where your school is, find out where what's happening with your families. You're worried about a family, come visit, like ask to come over and sit on the couch and talk. And you probably have resources and connections that they don't have access to as an educator. And you can recommend, hey, I've got this nonprofit that I know about that, you might want to try them. You're not going to push them and force them. They are in the driver's seat, but families want the best for their children, and they will take action when they see a possibility.
What Steve said was
Thanks.
so important. Being married to an educator for over 28 years, many teachers are already doing what Steve mentioned. They're buying things for their kids outside, from their own pocket. If a child doesn't have a coat, my wife has provided coats and shoes and undergarments and things of that nature. And a school can be very innovative in and of itself. If you wanted to develop your own clothing closet to support coats, school uniforms, and things like that, weekend and evening snacks, you could do so. But I think as large as a city such as New York is, with over 32 school districts, you can start, innovation starts very small. I think Steve is a powerful messenger. He is going to be that credible messenger to get the work done. And Steve could actually start a movement with one school in one community. And then the success of that one program will quickly spread. People often say that bad news spreads faster than good news. I think it's just the opposite. Good news spreads really fast. And once they start to see the success of that one location, because your spokespersons will be your family. It will be the mothers and the fathers or the grandparents that are benefiting from that success that's going to preach that message and support what you're doing. I think it could be done. If the state of Idaho is doing it in all of their counties, which Idaho still is, most of their cities are rural. But if it could be done statewide, it could be done in certain locales. And if it can actually be replicated in Philadelphia and Chicago, I think it could be done in New York as well. I'm just crazy enough to believe that.
Thank you, Steve Evangelista, educator, and Anthony Celestine of the Calcasieu Parish Office of Juvenile Justice Services. And thank you, listeners. Check out our new video series, What Would You Do? A collaboration with the Harvard Graduate School of Education and EdEthics. Go to our website, ethicalschools.org, and click video. The goal of the series is not to provide right answers, but to illustrate a variety of ethical viewpoints. If you found this podcast worthwhile, please share it with a friend or colleague. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review, because this helps others to find the show. Check out our website for more episodes and articles, and subscribe to our monthly emails. We post annotated transcripts of our interviews to make them easy to use in workshops or classes. And you can contact us at hosts@ethicalschools.org. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube. Our editor and social media manager is Amanda Denchi. Until next week. Thank you.